Hello, this is Angela Ewing with KCIW, Curry Coast Community Radio. Storytime. 9 o'clock horses. Episode 17. If you've ever read a book and then realized you had no idea of what you just read, that was how it was for me at that moment. I must have read the word several times before the meaning sank in. Even then, I did not quite believe the words. Colin Hadley believed dead? I read the telegram yet again. All I could say was no, no, no. No tears, just an agonizing no, no, no. I found the bottle of scotch I'd been saving for special occasions and drank half of it until I was totally drunk. I fell asleep in the chair. I woke up to a strip of daylight that slanted through the window below street level. I sat there for a long time in a daze. Vague thoughts drifted through my mind about where I was and why I was sitting in this dungeon-like room. Then it struck me, almost out of the blue. It was about Colin. Colin was dead? It sprang from nowhere, a wave of anger. I think I must have yelled out to no one. Has anyone seen his body? How did they know he was dead? Who said he was? If he was missing, how would they know he died? I really didn't refuse to believe it. And then I found a few airmail letters stuck in a drawer, and I sat down and wrote to Ellen. She must have some of the answers. Or, maybe, I should just go home to see her. I needed more answers about Colin. Surely the military would not dare to say he was dead unless they knew for sure, but then again. I took the airline ticket from its envelope, laid it on the table and stared at it. I wanted to call Jeremy to tell him I was going home, but I had no telephone and I was too hungover to go out of the apartment, even to walk to the corner telephone booth. It was all too much. I took some aspirin, went back to bed feeling that the end of the world had come and there was no point in living. I wanted to die. It was early afternoon when I finally surfaced enough to feel hungry. I stood by the tiny kitchen counter, eating scrambled eggs on toast. Then I went back to bed. I finally woke to the now familiar strip of brightness filtering through the low window. It was dawn. I dragged my suitcase out from under the bed and started to pack. Every now and then I went into the living room and just stared at the wall. I couldn't cry. It was unreal. Suddenly the whole room seemed to be crowding in on me. I had to get outside, take a walk, anything to be out of this place. I rose, dressed quickly, and fled out the door and onto the quiet street. Even as the city came alive, I walked. Head held high, I walked for hours, not really thinking, just walking, my mind a total blank. I found myself at the subway entrance, and soon I had boarded the train for 7th Avenue. I made my way to the Duluth studio. I hoped Ron would let me use his telephone to call my father. He was the one I wanted to talk to first. I would tell him I'd failed, that Colin was dead and I would be coming home and that I was to blame for his death. It was almost impossible to make an international call from a telephone box. I didn't know how to do it or how to pay for it, how many coins would I need and all that. It was a quick trip from Flatbush Avenue to Manhattan by subway and to Ron's studio. Again, his friend answered the door. He invited me in and introduced himself, this time as Bernardo. When Ron appeared, he said, "Well, they're not ready yet, your photos." Then he must have noticed my face, no makeup, my hair stringy and lifeless around my face. "Okay now, what's all this about?" he said. "You look like hell."
I know, I said. I just want to talk to you if you have a minute. And I need to make a telephone call to England, please. Colin is dead, I blurted it out.
Even the words sound alien to my own ears.
Whoa, whoa, back up there, Ron came to me, put an arm around my shoulders and led me into their sitting room.
Let's get you some coffee.
He nodded to Bernardo, who went out presumably to make it.
Thank you, I mumbled.
Their sitting room was cool, small, with a few pieces of antique furniture and a worn brown leather sofa. Bernardo brought the coffee in on a silver tray. They both sat with me while I told them all about Colin and the telegram and that I had decided to go back home to England. They listened attentively and made comments.
How terrible for you, oh, or, oh, that's awful.
They both agreed.
What can we do to help? Bernardo asked.
Nothing, I answered. I just needed someone to talk to.
Ron refilled my coffee.
I'll see if I can develop your photographs tomorrow. I can cancel one of my girls. I do want you to see them before you leave.
At that moment, I didn't really care about the photographs. I just wanted to go back home.
Bernardo said, you know, I think you should stay and take the job here. England will still be there if you don't like the work. I expect your ticket home is valid for a few more months.
Oh, I don't know what the point would be staying here now, I said.
Well, what's the point of going back to England? Ron smiled. Think about it. You will have your family, sure, but unless your old firm wants to take you back, you'll have to look for work there. You've got a promise of employment here. Why not give it a try?
Oh, I don't know, I said. I can't live in that apartment you found for me. I'm grateful to you, but it's awful.
Ron said, ah.
There was silence for a while. Then Bernardo said, if you do decide not to go back home, I have an idea that you could stay with my mother in Rockaway. I bet she'd be glad of your company. She has a nice house close to the beach. Why don't I call and ask her?
I shook my head, thinking about Aunt Olive and my parents. Oh, I should go back. Please, can I use your telephone?
Ron called the international operator and handed me the telephone. I was glad my parents were modernized now with a telephone. When it began to ring, I felt tears suddenly coursing down my cheeks. It was the first time I'd cried. The ringing seemed to go on for a long time before my mother's voice came over the line. Amelia, at last, we've been so worried about you.
I was blubbering.
I sent you letters.
What's the matter?
I could hardly utter the words.
Colin was killed in Vietnam.
Oh, no. Oh, God, oh, how terrible. Amelia, how terrible.
I heard her turn away from the phone, but her voice was clear. Amelia's on the phone.
There was silence for a few minutes and faint voices. Then my father's voice.
Your mother said Colin is dead.
Yes, I could hardly say the words. Yeah, in Vietnam.
Then I couldn't speak. I pulled a handkerchief out of my pocket with my left hand, holding the telephone away from my face while I blew my nose.
You come home right now, my father's voice was firm.
No need to stay there. Nothing you can do. Do you have money for the fare?
Suddenly, I didn't want to talk any more about it. I finally managed.
I gotta go. I gotta go. All right, bye.
Just as I replaced the telephone in its cradle, I heard my father, Amelia! In front of me on the table was a glass of shining brown liquid. Bernardo said, drink of this, you'll feel better.
It was brandy, and the harshness hit my throat like fire.
Ron said, you know, I agree with Bernardo. I think you're making a big mistake going home.
Anyway, he looked at the clock on the wall. Hey, girl, hey, I have an appointment I can't afford to miss. Stay here with Bernardo, okay?
It occurred to me then I had barged into this place unannounced, and of course they had work to do. I should get out. I rose and apologized for coming, but then Bernardo rose from his chair and motioned for me to stay seated.
I'm serious, he said. My mama would love to meet you, you know. So please, come with me this afternoon, okay? I said, well, I could go out this afternoon and take a look at the area, I suppose. Okay, yes. Is that all right? Sure, Bernardo said. I take you. It will be good to see my mum. Rockaway Beach is on a peninsula on the south shore of Long Island in the borough of Queens. Bernardo took me to the boardwalk first. The beach was crowded with young people, most looking as though they had spent a lot of time in the sun. Some bikinied women were playing volleyball. The net was strung between two posts in the sand. Bernardo's mother was Zanetta Basile. He called her Netta, and she was happy to see him with kisses and hugs, and a hug for me. Yes, she said in her pronounced Italian accent. Of course you'll stay here. You'll come. I show you the room. See, it has its own bathroom. But I cook the meals. You join me for meals, yes? Yes, I said. That would be wonderful. At that moment, I let myself feel comforted by the warmth of this woman and good smells that emanated from her kitchen. Somehow, I had the feeling that Netta Basile would be my savior, and she was. For the first time since I arrived in the States, I felt at home. Netta was true to her word and shared her meals with me. She seemed to be happy to mother me. I think if she had not been there, I would have gone back home to UK. There was so much sadness to deal with. I wondered if I would ever be free of the guilt. I liked the work at Lerner Hitchinson Corporation, although the trek in the mornings was grueling. Train, then bus into Manhattan. At least I had found there was some sort of normalcy in the routine of getting up and having a job to go to. I had gained a friend with Netta and the boys, as she referred to Bernardo and Ron. Photographs were developed. Ron said if I gave permission, he would send six of the best to Playboy magazine. Somehow, it didn't look like me in those nude photos, especially the ones he took from the floor. I didn't think anyone would recognize me. I decided to say yes, provided he changed the name on the paperwork. He sighed. So, what name do you want? It didn't take long for me to decide. My father told me that he had wanted to name me Julia, and I chose a last name as Lester. Different spelling to the city of my birth. Is that the name you want to be called, Julia Lester? Bernardo asked. Just for this photo, I said. When Ellen wrote saying it would just as well that I forgot Colin and got on with my life, I told her she was being ridiculous. I wrote back again saying that I had some doubts about Colin being killed. She had sighed. You should find a nice young man and settle down. Could I really accept the fact that Colin was never coming back to me? How could I just go on with someone else? No, I thought, I'd better resign myself to the fact I'd never meet anyone as wonderful as Colin. I would remain single for the rest of my life, and what was wrong with that? After a few months at the office on Broad Street, I decided I needed to find something to do after my 3:30 p.m. deadline when the market closed. Our days began at 7 a.m., and I wasn't ready to go back to Rockaway at 4 in the afternoon. Every day, on my way to the subway, I passed the McKinley Dance Studio. Memories of my dancing days came back to me when I heard the music. I had taken lessons at the Granby Halls in Leicester with Kevin, and the examinations for bronze and silver medals back then, and now I knew I would possibly be allowed to teach with those kind of credentials. The boss was Russian, a Mr. Udovin. He said he would give me a try. I had no doubt about my own routine and dance steps, although when he whirled me around the floor in a two-step, the sequence was different. But he was a strong leader and definitely took charge. I was hired. Teaching dancing at McKinley Dance Studio was fun. It was only 2 hours a day from 4 to 6, but it filled my day nicely and I didn't have to think as much about Colin. I took seniors mostly,
along with the young man Darren, who partnered the women. I taught the waltz, or swing, to the men who signed a contract for 6 weeks at quite a fee. I didn't realize until I'd been there for a month or so that Mr. Udovin expected his girls to have sex with him. According to Jasmine, a tall, willowy girl of 19, it was just par for the course. Those who were regularly trapped in Mr. Udovin's office with the door locked, I suspected, were victims of his desires. I was disgusted and determined not to be trapped in his office. Then one evening, just as I had finished with my last student, I stepped into his office to show him the last contract for a 6-week course. "Good, good," he said. "Come, let's look at this." I went to his desk and stood by his side while he looked at the contract before him. He seemed to be studying the contract with interest, and then I felt his hand on my back, and he was lifting my skirt. This man had photographs of his wife and children in beautiful frames on the walls and on his desk. I felt the heat rise to my cheeks and I pulled away. "You disgusting creature," I said. He laughed. "You won't get your commission on these sales, girlie." I turned and ran out the door, grabbed my purse and cardigan from the locker room, and fled into the street. I had made arrangements to meet a friend from the brokerage for a drink at one of the hotels on Lexington, and when she arrived, I was already on my second glass of wine. I told her how upset I was, and she said, "Oh, honey, men are such pigs, and I don't think that's unusual. It happens more time than you'd think, with employers." "I hope not," I said. For some reason, I started to cry. But then, lots of things and situations set me off into a crying jag. "It's okay, honey," she said, putting her arm around my shoulders. She repeated, "Ah, men are such pigs." Somehow, that event did colour my thoughts about the city. I was suddenly aware of the streets, echoing with the noises of people and cars, the ubiquitous steam that sprang from the vents in the pavement. The hot, stifling city of Manhattan was suddenly a nasty place to live. Again, the notion of returning to England, it was only the thought that I would be totally broke if I did. And I couldn't bear the thought of living with my parents again. I remained at the brokerage for another year. The girls were pleasant enough, and I got used to the letters from the brokers. I used to read the ticker tape to customers who called to hear how the market was doing. There were no computers. Phones were busy all day long. I learned the highs and lows of the stock market. I went out a couple of times with David, a nice man, who was more interested in me than I was in him. I had the barrier up. I wasn't keen to go out with any of the men there. For one thing, most of them were married. I had learned my nude photographs were not accepted by the magazine, and I was glad. It had been a worry to me, although I never saw them again and often wondered if Ron sold them or just dumped them. I would never know. It was Netta who made me feel that life was worthwhile. She told me a lot about her childhood growing up in the big city of Florence in Italy. She taught me how to cook real Italian food, not meatballs and spaghetti. She said their main entree was usually a meat sauce on a bed of polenta. She served veal, which I was not keen on because of the way it was said the animals were raised. And her pizza was nothing like anything I had tasted before. No meat on it ever. Sometimes Bernardo and Ron came for dinner. They were pleasant, Sunday dinners, almost like our dinners at home, a family time. One evening, when I had offered to pick up a prescription for Netta from the Rexall Drug on 29th Street, I met Joseph. It was a blustery late afternoon, and it had just begun to rain. I had been to the drugstore many times and had become friendly with the staff. Joseph, the pharmacist, was 6 feet tall, with black curly hair and an eager smile. He always laughed a lot with his helpers, who obviously enjoyed working there. They seemed a happy bunch. He greeted me with his usual smile, and I noticed his eyes looked incredibly large behind his thick glasses.
His long, dark lashes swept the glass. I wondered if that bothered him. I heard him tell the staff to go home because of the impending storm. I heard the doors in the back close, and then he came to the counter and handed me the filled prescription for Netta. He said, "You know it's going to rain. It's a nasty night out there. I'm going to lock up early. Do you want a ride home?" The wind howled around the place, and I accepted gratefully. On the way out of the back door, he picked up an umbrella from the big ceramic pot in the corner and flicked it open, holding me close, as we ran to his car. I had never been inside a Cadillac before. It gleamed inside, and I presumed that it must be highly polished on the outside, too. As he pulled over to the curb outside Netta's, he said, "My cosmetic girl is getting married, and I need someone in the evenings just for 3 hours. 3 nights a week. Do you know of anyone who might fit the bill?" I told him I didn't know anyone locally, but maybe I could help out for a while. The hours would suit me, now I wasn't at the dance studio, although I knew Netta would always expect me to be home for dinner. I decided I'd give it a try. It was only 5 to 8 in the evenings. Extra money would come in handy too. It was the start of a new life for me, a wonderful era, but one, again, that would not last very long. You have been listening to 9 o'clock Horses, episode 17. Listen next week to episode 18 on Curry Coast Community Radio. This is Angela Ewing. Thank you for listening.